Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 74, recorded October 17th, 2012. David O. Triangulation is brought to you by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, visit Stamps.com, click the microphone, and enter Triangulation. And by Ford. Featuring available Ford Sync. Now you can control your media player with simple voice commands. Enjoy your drive while you easily search and listen to your favorite songs. Check Sync out on the 2012 Ford Focus or at Ford.com/technology. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get to talk to the most interesting people doing the most interesting things, big thinkers. And we've got a great big thinker for you today on triangulation. People sometimes say, why do you call it triangulation? Well, originally it was me, Tom Merritt, and our guest. So there were three sides to that triangle. But now it's just me and the guest. And the third side of the triangle is you at home. So we have more than 1,000 people watching the show live, and many of them in our chat room. And this is going to be a great one for you to ask questions, because I know you are all very interested in the Mars Curiosity mission. We, in fact, covered the landing of Curiosity live on the TWiT network. And I'll never forget, I was at home watching while Tom and the crew did that live coverage. And I really got excited because I realized that, yeah, mainstream media was covering it a little bit. CNN, you know, was covering it a little bit. Then they went away to something else. But our audience was so engaged, so fascinated, so excited about what was going on. I realized that this is something that's important to us and something that we want to do a lot more of. And so today we've got the lead flight director for the Curiosity mission. David O. is joining us. Curiosity, of course, is the Mars science lab that is currently wandering around the red planet. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Leo. It's a pleasure.
Great to have you here. So let me ask you about your background. Are you an engineer? What's your background?
My background is I am an engineer. I'm an MIT graduate, graduated with a PhD from there in 1996. I have an engineering degree. I also have a music degree. I have an undergraduate degree in music from MIT also from 1991.
That's awesome. What kind of music?
I did a lot of singing, did a lot of choral music, classical music, and I'm a tenor.
People don't really think of MIT as a place for choral music.
Actually, it had quite a strong music program when I was there. And the director of the MIT choir was also the director of the Tanglewood Festival choir, for anybody who's familiar with that.
Oh, yeah, so Tanglewood's wonderful, yeah.
It was a great experience.
So that there does seem to always have been a nexus between engineers, scientists, programmers, and musicians. It's, I guess, the same side of the brain or something.
I think that there is. There were a lot of musicians at MIT, a lot of performers, even though there weren't so many majors because it was a technical school. And I actually know three people who worked in rock music and then became rocket scientists at JPL or other places. So it's more common than you'd think.
Gives new meaning to the word rocket. I know Richard Feynman liked to play his bongos, but I don't think he was a serious musician. But I think there's a music is mathematical, ultimately.
Yeah, and I won't say that I understand why there's so many musicians have the technical background, but there's a certain set of relationships there and a certain creativity also I think that goes with it.
So what was your PhD in? Was it in space?
It was in space. It was in plasma thrusters. So I was a rocket scientist. I still am a rocket scientist.
Literally.
Absolutely.
Wait a minute. You could get a doctorate in plasma thrusters?
It's in astronautical engineering. What I studied was what are called Hall effect thrusters. It's a type of plasma thruster.
Was that your thesis?
It was my thesis.
Do they use plasma thrusters now, or is that something futuristic? Is that Star Trek technology?
At the time, they weren't used very often, but now they're used all the time. The satellites that carry DirecTV and Sirius satellite radio, they all use these plasma thrusters, ion thrusters, and Hall thrusters. There are over 200 spacecraft in orbit that use these thrusters.
So normally thrusters are rocket fuel, like the boosters that launched Curiosity. But a plasma thruster is what, charged matter?
So it's a form of what we call electric propulsion. And what we do is, instead of using heat from chemicals to drive the rocket, you use electricity and you ionize particles, charge them up, and then you can accelerate them using electricity.
More efficient?
It's much, much more efficient. In terms of efficiency, it's like 5, 6, 7 times more efficient in rocket fuel. You use a lot less fuel when you do it that way. But you don't get as much thrust, so you got to be willing to take your time to get places.
It's for people who aren't in a big hurry, like Sirius satellite. They're not there. We'll get there. Eventually, we'll get there. So let's see, 96. So that means that you were born after Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. You didn't get to see that growing up. Did you follow space as a kid, though? Did you watch later Apollo launches, things like that?
Well, let me correct you. I was actually born, I think, 4 months before Neil Armstrong.
Oh, right then. Yeah.
So I think I did watch it, but I don't remember it. I did watch space growing up. I remember the Viking landings on Mars.
Yeah.
I remember the Apollo-Soyuz mission. I remember the first flight of the space shuttle. I remember Voyager when it went to see Neptune and when it went to see Uranus. Yeah, it was all part of my upbringing.
That inspire you? Did you think then that you wanted to be a rocket scientist?
I think it was always something that I wanted to do. When I went to college, I wasn't sure exactly what I was going to do. But when I was choosing what I would major in, I definitely went back to all these things that I'd seen and the excitement of space. And I was part of the Star Wars generation. You know, I remember seeing that movie.
I talk to scientists a lot who say science fiction heavily influenced not only their excitement about science, but actually about sometimes about the stuff they studied and did work on.
Yeah, I think it really did influence where I ended up going. But I wasn't someone who was just gung-ho space from the very beginning. It wasn't until I got to college that I started looking around and saying, well, what can I do with this, with an engineering degree? What would be fun to do?
Right.
Rocket science looks good.
Did you want to become an astronaut? Did you want to be somebody who would go on a manned mission?
No, I didn't. You can't tell from the screen, but I'm actually too short to be an astronaut. So I always wanted to work more on the engineering side, building things. Building robots. Building a Mars rover, I think, has been on my list for a long time. That's been on the list of things I want to do for forever.
So tell me when your involvement with Curiosity began.
I got involved with the Curiosity rover and really with the Mars program 6 years ago, almost 7 years ago now, when they were just finishing up their preliminary design and have been working on it ever since. I was one of the lead and systems engineers for their electronics and their power systems. So I had a team of people who were delivering computers and power and telecommunications to the rover. And it's been a big journey over 6 years getting it to the surface of Mars.
That's so cool. How did you become the lead flight director? That sounds like a pretty important job.
I actually did not come straight to JPL. So I worked for 7 years on communication satellites up there in Northern California, in Palo Alto, Space Systems Loral.
Okay.
And then I'm finishing my 9th year at JPL. So it's a combination of experience and then the time I spent working on the Mars rover. I guess they liked me enough to make me lead flight director.
That must have been pretty fun. That must have been an exciting day when they said, hey, David, how'd you like to run this thing?
Yeah, that wasn't a bad day at all. That was a good day.
And yet, there's got to be some pressure. You know, when I first heard about how you were going to land Curiosity, I really thought, there's no way they can do that. And you weren't able to test it, were you?
We were never able to completely test the landing system because the gravity on Earth is 3 times heavier than the gravity on Mars. So we can't run the landing system. We'd always crash every time on Earth. So we tested it in pieces. We did simulations. We counted on data taken in the 70s on parachutes and did wind tunnel tests. We did everything we could. But we could never test it end to end. And we weren't sure that it was going to work on landing day. It was definitely not a sure thing. So I was really glad to get that thing landed on the surface of Mars.
I think we could tell that because we were all glued to JPL during this landing. We watched with such interest. It was so compelling. And you could, I hate to say it, but I could see you guys sweating a little bit, right? And the relief when, as stage by stage, things went well was absolutely palpable.
Yeah, it was pure joy when we landed that thing.
I bet.
And you know, the guy, Alan Chen, who's the guy who's reading out all the events as they happened, he'd been working on the Curiosity rover for 10 years of his career.
Holy
cow. So it was all on the line right there.
10 years of work on the line. And you did... you probably don't want to answer it, but how confident were you this was going to work?
I will say I wasn't 100% confident, but I will say that I was confident that we had done everything that we could and that we had the best people on the planet working on it. So you reach a point, at least I did, where I said, well, I've done everything I can, and it's time to sit back and let this happen and, you know, we'll eat our peanuts and we'll say our prayers and we'll see if we have a good day or not.
We all ate peanuts, by the way. I just want you to know that there were plenty of people here on watching our network, watching the NASA feed, talking about it and eating peanuts with you guys going, come on, baby, come on.
You know, we got a thank you note from the National Peanut Council 2 weeks later.
You sold a lot of peanuts.
I didn't even know there was a National Peanut Council. So there's something I learned from this mission.
I think I tweeted, is it okay to eat peanut butter? Because that's all I got. but when they told you, okay, so here's the idea. We're going to hover a platform. Well, there's a I guess first you have a problem. How do we land this without stirring up so much dust that the thing is useless?
That's right.
So what was proposed? I know the previous mission, I loved it. You bounced that ball. That was crazy enough.
That was, I would say that. And actually, it was kind of funny to hear people, they look at the sky crane, as we called it, with the big rocket pack and lowering the thing down, and they'd be like, well, that looks dangerous. Why don't you do it the way you did it last time? And when you kind of step back and you go, well, the last time we took a whole bunch of airbags and blew it up and bounced it on the surface. You know, starting from scratch, would you really say that that's a more reasonable way to land? You kind of get used to it after a while. It's funny what people get used to, right? Oh, we did it like that last time. It must be.
It worked.
It worked, right? Well, it looked just as crazy the first time they did it in 1996.
I agree 100%.
Yeah.
So who was it that came up with the idea of, okay, we will – in fact, we had – for our coverage, we had an interview with Steve Sell, who, of course – was responsible for that sky crane. Was it Steve's idea to do that? Who came up with that one?
I don't actually know the person who came up with it. I think there's a team of people who worked on it hard. And it's one of these things where in its initial conception on the back of a napkin, it looks kind of crazy. But when you think about it and
makes sense.
Well, would you really rather have the rockets on the bottom? Or on the top. Actually, you'd really rather have the rockets on the top.
Right.
And everything else kind of drops out naturally from that if you work your way through the math and all the different options that you got. So it looks crazy, but it is really the product of great engineers doing their best to come up with the best way to land.
Well, and it makes engineering rock stars. It's like these guys are the coolest guys on the planet because they not only dreamed it up, they figured out the equations, they never got to test it, and they had the confidence to say, you know, this will work, and do it. And it did!
Absolutely, it did.
It worked! And I think some of the pleasure of seeing it work was the sense that it might not work, right?
Oh, absolutely. It was an absolute load off my shoulders to see that thing on the ground. It was just a tremendous... wait, I think, for all of us to watch it and go, is this going to land? Is it going to land? But it did. And so now we can be happy and maybe someday we'll get to do it again. So it's a good day.
Let's talk about Curiosity. It's the size of a Volkswagen.
Right.
Is that the biggest thing we've ever landed on a foreign body? It's bigger than the Apollo, right?
I don't think it's bigger than the Apollo landers. Those are pretty
big. Those are big. You're right. Yeah.
Because we didn't have to carry a person.
Right.
But we went a lot farther. We went 150 million miles.
8 months.
It weighs a ton. It's certainly the biggest rover we've ever put down. And it's kind of the size of a Volkswagen. I'd say when you've got all the arms and appendages and the head out, it's more the size of a Jeep, a small SUV. It's really quite a thing there. And it has 10 scientific instruments on it. It has two scientific laboratories built into it, where they took laboratories that would take a whole room on Earth and put them down into boxes the size of a backpack and packed them in there.
Amazing.
And it's got a drill. It's got laser. It's got high-definition video cameras. It's got all sorts of stuff on it. Great stuff.
Incredibly sophisticated. It's an interesting challenge because it's 14 minutes after you give a command that it receives it. So is it mostly autonomous?
It does. It actually has to do most of its work effectively autonomously. We, on surface, operate – well, first of all, when it landed, it had to do everything by itself because it's only 7 minutes from the top of the atmosphere to the ground, and we're 14 light minutes away, so we can't do anything to help it. It's got to do it all by itself. And then when it's on the surface, we don't talk to it all the time. We actually normally talk to it. We send orders to it only once per day, and then it goes off and does its thing and reports back to us at the end of the day. We look at what it did over the course of the Martian night, and then we come back and give it another set of orders the next day. So mostly it does its work autonomously.
The software that's controlling it, how sophisticated is that? I mean, is it you have effectively PowerPC processors on there.
Yes, we have a RAD 750, which is derived from a PowerPC. It is a much slower processor than you would see. It's in the 120, 130 megahertz clock range, which is to say 10 times slower than the processor in my iPhone.
Right.
So it's a lot slower. It's got 4 gigabytes of RAM. It's very sophisticated software.
What do they write that in? Is it C++? Is it...
It's actually written in C. It's written in straight C.
Straight C.
Yeah.
ADA, not some special NASA programming language, just C.
No, it's not even object-oriented. It's just straight C.
I kind of like that, actually. I think that's good.
And do programming down at the bit level. I mean, all the drivers that are used on it are custom written for it. All, you know, down to the drivers that do communication and talk to instruments and run serial buses. All of that stuff is custom, so that we know what it does.
Is that because it's so all the hardware is so unique, or is it? Why is it that it's all custom written?
It is unique hardware. We use some standard serial buses and stuff like that, but we use them with our own protocols. And the hardware is all built at JPL in the United States. The processor's not the processor we get from outside, but many of the electrical boards, all of the parts that are machined in Pasadena.
Interesting.
It's really something that's made entirely in the United States.
Totally custom.
It's largely custom.
Yeah.
That is.
So that's why you have to write custom software. That makes a lot of sense.
And we're trying to do a lot with it in a relatively, compared to like an iPhone, a relatively not powerful processor.
Right.
And we have to make it super reliable because it has to be able to recover on its own. So it's not like the software that's running in a Mac or a PC. It's very different.
Well, and all software has bugs, but you can't afford really to have you can't crash the computer.
Yes and no. I mean, we actually deal with the fact that the computer may crash, and we build in as much as possible redundancy so that the system can recover. The system actually has two computers on it. There was one running primary, and there was another running backup. And there was some software running on the backup that would try and take over if the main computer crashed while we were trying to land on Mars. But again, it wasn't a sure thing. I think we were a lot happier to go down on the main processor.
Yeah.
And swap in the middle.
No. And have there been crashes? Have you had to press the reset button at all, or has it been pretty reliable?
We have had resets that happened. We had resets that happened when we first launched it, that we uncovered some bugs that were deep, deep down in the hardware.
Oh, wow.
That we fixed on the way to Mars. So that kind of stuff happens.
I think this is also part of the mythos of JPL, of NASA, of these kinds of missions, is the MacGyver-like ingenuity. That you know it's you only got what you got, and you got to figure out ways to solve problems that you may not have anticipated, or you have to anticipate as many as you can, and yet things happen.
Right, and a lot of the challenge comes from the time limits we work with, because you can only launch to Mars at certain points in time.
Right.
So if you have a hard deadline and the deadline isn't something that some manager told you, the deadline is set by the alignment of the planets. So you're either going to make that deadline or you're going to miss by 2 years. Oh, and
really? Is that how – that's how the window is every 2 years or something like that?
That's right. There's a 30-day window every 2 years.
That's it?
That's it.
Oh, wow. That doesn't give you a lot of you can't slip the ship. You have to get it out there.
Well, now it is true, in fairness, that the rover was originally supposed to launch in 2009.
Okay.
And after looking at how difficult it was, we decided, you know, we need to wait longer. So we pushed it 2 more years so we could land safely, which we did.
And the bit rate of the connection is what, 500 kilobits per sec? What is the bit rate between you and the
Astor? Bit rate's a funny concept. So when you're on the surface of Mars, you don't actually talk directly to the rover. The rover doesn't talk directly to us most of the time. It talks to a satellite that's in orbit around Mars.
Right.
And that goes back to us at Earth. The peak data rate is around 2 megabits per second, which is a little faster than T1 line.
That's pretty good, yeah.
But you can only talk to it for a few minutes a day.
Oh.
So we get about, on average, 400 megabits a day, which is, say, 50 megabytes a day down from the rover. And that, so like at home, I have a DSL line. It does 6 megabits per second. It's the equivalent of every day I get to go on the web and use my DSL line for 1 minute, and then it turns off. And then the rest of the day, I'm just working off that 1 minute worth of data I got, that 50 megabytes, to try and decide what I'm going to send to it for the next day. And the next day I send it, and I get another minute's worth of data to look at it, and then come back. So it's not that much, but it's enough.
You've got to be very patient to be a space scientist, obviously.
You do have to be patient, yeah. And we're also very strict in prioritizing what things are coming down when, and,
right.
And there's a whole protocol for making sure the most important things come down first.
Is most of that 50 megabytes telemetry, images?
In terms of data volume, a lot of it is images, but the first things that come down are always telemetry.
Right.
Because we always want to make sure the rover's safe and sound,
right.
And that things happen like they were supposed to. And then we start getting scientific data and images. The images take up just a lot of the bandwidth because they're so big. And you can take – there are pictures that are still on board the rover. There are pictures that we've taken that will probably never come down.
What?
Because they're on the cameras, and we just don't have the bandwidth to bring them down. So we have to make intelligent decisions about which pictures to bring down and which ones not to.
Wow. I had no idea. So there's a backlog of data.
Yeah, there's a backlog of data. The cameras each have – there are 4 cameras that have 8 gigabytes of memory built into each one of them. So there's lots of memory there to store images, and it'll download like thumbnails to us, and then we'll go through and decide which ones are the good ones down and things like that.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Right.
You use Lightroom, you go through it, you say this one, this one, this one. Do you are you planning – come on, you admit it. You're planning a manned mission to get the compact flash card from the camera at a later date.
That would be very cool.
I would love that, and that may happen. We're talking to David O. It is such a thrill to talk to you, David, and we're so excited about what you're doing. I have so many questions, my own and the chat rooms. We're going to ask some more in just a bit. I also want to talk about – living on Mars time, because I know you and your family did that. I think that's kind of a cool idea. Your son has his own blog all about living on Mars time. We'll talk more about that in a second. Our show today brought to you by Stamps.com. So I think for some people, going to the post office is a little bit like a trip to Mars. Something you kind of, you can put it off if you might want to. That's why I love Stamps.com. You could do it all from your desk using the magic of the internet. Stamps.com lets you print official U.S. postage with your computer, your printer, whenever you need it, on demand. They even give you a great USB scale so you never need, spend more on postage than you need to. You always know exactly how much. It's always up to date. You don't have to worry about a change in prices. You don't need a postage meter. You don't need special ink. You just need Stamps.com. And it's really designed to integrate with your workflow. If you do a lot of mailing, you use QuickBooks to do invoices or other mailings, it'll take the addresses from your QuickBooks address book, print them right on the envelope along with the postage, your company's logo, whatever you want. Same thing, eBay, Etsy, Amazon, PayPal. It will take the data from the web page. You don't have to cut and paste. It just does it all automatically. If you do international mailing, you'll love Stamps.com. It fills out the forms for you. And the beauty is you never have to get up and go to the post office. The mail carrier comes to you. You can even schedule free pickups and takes your stuff, takes your forms, and you're good to go. The post office loves Stamps.com. It gets you out of the lines at the post office and makes them more efficient. In fact, that's why they give you discounts you cannot get at the post office. 21% on express mail, 15% on priority mail, and there's discounts on international mailing as well. Look, find out more. Just go to Stamps.com. Now, you see right there on the front page of Stamps.com a special $80 offer. You might say, that's great, $25 free postage. I get the scale, the supply kit, the trial. No, I could do better. Click the Hear About Us on a radio or podcast, click that microphone right there. And then enter our offer code, which is Triangulation. That's the name of the show, Triangulation. Press go. And now that $80 offer magically transmogrifies into a $110 bonus offer, $55 in free postage. You still get the digital scale, the supply kit, the four-week trial. Stamps.com. Try it right now. $55 in free postage. That's pretty good incentive to give it a try. Stamps.com. Please use our offer code, Triangulation. Oh, what a this is really a fun interview for me because I've been I grew up watching Walter Cronkite as the through Mercury, through Gemini, through Apollo. I always wanted to be an astronaut, and we got the next best thing. David O., lead flight director of the Curiosity Mars Space Laboratory mission that you perhaps saw just a few months ago land on Mars. Curiosity's wandering around. Are you getting the kind of data that you were hoping for, David?
I think we're getting great stuff. We're getting great pictures, and the pictures are
they're stunning,
are wonderful. And we're starting to do some real science now, so I think that's great stuff. We loaded sand into one of the chemical laboratories on board last night, so we'll get to see the results of our analysis today. That'll be good stuff.
How did this work? Is it like the Hubble where different scientists all over the world apply and say, I want my experiment, I want my data? How does that work?
It's kind of like that, but it's all done on a much faster schedule. So we have hundreds of scientists who are working on this right now, but every day we have to come up with a plan for what the rover is going to do next. So the scientists meet in groups by themselves, and then we all come together into a big science meeting, and then they meet with the engineers every day and decide what's going to happen next, and then they kind of vote on it, work it through, get a consensus on what's going to happen, and then we go on to the next step. So, yeah, the scientists have a lot going into it, but each instrument, and there are 10 instruments, has its own little group of scientists working with it, deciding what they want to do.
NASA has been, and JPL has been fantastic lately in terms of how they do outreach. The great videos we've seen on YouTube, the Twitter account Curiosity is tweeting. Is that who is that, by the way? Is that a single person or?
There are a couple people in our outreach office that specialize in social media.
It's
and
great.
I've got to say that they've done a great job.
Yeah, because it really grabs people's imagination. How much of the science you do is influenced by that? I mean, part of your mission really. I mean, nobody wants to say that, you're pure scientists, but is also to get the hearts and minds of the American public behind you so that you can continue to do this kind of stuff.
No, I think that's really important. And I think it's been really great how the social media folks have engaged. I don't mean our social media folks. I mean everybody out in the internet. Because like you said, the broadcast networks have been kind of carrying this every once in a while.
Yeah.
On landing day, most of the networks didn't cut away to see it. But on the internet, it was seen, and there was just an incredible intensity
huge.
To it.
Yeah.
And people really, really want to learn about it. And I think that's great. I mean, I think it's really great
to
see.
Well, for instance, one of the things that would capture CNN's attention is proof of life, proof of water. Do you prioritize those experiments because you know that they'll be of great interest? or does the scientist say, no, we're going to do the hard science. We're going to do what we need to do.
I think the scientists largely go off with their scientific goals to do the things that they want to do for science.
Right.
And other folks then look at what they're doing and just translate it into the things that people understand. Other people who are non-scientists
understand it in the media.
Because they do plenty of cool stuff.
Right.
It's just a matter of telling people about it. And then prior to landing, you know, we had a bunch of social media folks, people who did Twitter and Facebook, actually come into Mission Control, and they got to come in just like the regular press got to come in and ask us questions and do that kind of thing. That was great.
You did a great job with that. And many of my friends were part of those groups that got to be there that night. And it did help a lot because we felt like we were all participating directly in that amazing event. So what, any surprises so far in the scientific mission?
I was surprised that they picked up the evidence that there was water on Mars so quickly. They announced that they looked at the pebbles on the ground and they could see because they were rounded.
They looked like river rocks.
Yeah, that we've landed in an ancient riverbed and that there was water flowing and they can tell us how fast it was flowing and how deep it was. It's amazing.
Those geologists, they're amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing.
My dad's a geologist and that always blows me away because he could totally do that. He'd say, oh, yeah, that well, you see that there, that kid. How do you know that? Well, that's we know that.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Another interesting thing is when we landed, you know, we had the whole sky crane and we had the rockets up high to keep debris from getting on the rover. But when we took pictures of the top of the rover after we landed, we could still see like dust and rocks, things that have been blown up there. So that's a sign that next time we need to make that whole bride a little longer, I think. I guess 20 feet wasn't enough. We'll have to go for more next time.
But you kind of knew because you had the lens caps and you have some weird windshield wiper system, so you're able to clear the lenses off.
Yeah, the lens cap is transparent, so
it
just falls off. Blow off the lens cap, and then we can see clearly again. So they had planned for it, but I still think they got more than they expected. There's always surprises.
The pictures are mind-boggling. I mean, the pictures are incredible. In fact, they're too good. They look like we're in Tucson. I mean, it's like people say, this looks like Earth and, you know, in the middle of the Arizona or somewhere.
Yeah.
It's real.
It's real. It's amazing to sit in the Mission Control Center at 2 o'clock in the morning and get a new set of pictures down from Mars and look at it and go, well, we're the first people on Earth to ever see these pictures. And they're beautiful.
Well, even during the landing, when we got the first images, the first thumbnails came over, I get chills still thinking about it. It was just so exciting.
Absolutely. And that was when I was really waiting for that moment, because even though we got the data saying we'd landed well, I really wanted to see those pictures that showed we were flat on the ground, the wheels were on the ground, we weren't turned sideways or something bizarre like that. I was so happy to see those pictures.
Correct me if I'm wrong, it couldn't have gone better.
It's hard to see how it could have gone better. It really just went wonderfully. I certainly wouldn't complain. I would do it all over again.
Just the neatest thing in the world. And, you know, we want to see more of this kind of thing. Now, I think one of the reasons that perhaps the mainstream media wasn't so captivated by this, and I was thinking this on Sunday when I was watching Felix Baumgartner basically fall out of a weather balloon. And there was, 8 million people watched it. And, you know, there was this gloss of science around it, but basically it's a stunt. And there was so much attention, and I was thinking, why this? And then I realized why. Because there's a human. And even though from a purely scientific point of view, it makes absolute sense. It's crazy to send people to Mars. It makes it so much easier. Even the moon, unmanned missions just make a lot more sense. But they don't grab you in the same way.
Yeah, I think one of the lessons I've learned from this, because I'm an engineer. Okay, I think just landing the rover in and of itself is really, really cool.
Awesome. Yeah. It's awesome. But nobody's life was at stake, I guess. That's what.
And if you look at the people, what happened afterwards in the press, you know, the types – people really want that human element in the story. So the types of people that the press latched onto, there's the guy with the mohawk, Bob Eck.
Mohawk guy, yeah.
It's the guy who used to play rock music, right, Adam. When news came out that my family was doing this Mars Time thing, it was
that's
us. They needed that human element.
Right.
To grab onto. And I think that's something – that's a lesson I'm going to take with me as I contemplate what we should do next in the space program.
We're humans.
It's not just about the robots.
We're humans.
Yeah.
And while you can get so much information, if you really want to care about something, a human has to be involved. That's true in sports. It's true in everything.
Yeah.
Unfortunately or unfortunately, it's just how we're made. It's just the way that it is. So let's talk about the human interest story. So all the scientists at JPL on this program are living on Mars time. What is Mars time?
Well, as I mentioned much earlier, when we operate on Mars, we have to operate on rover time because the rover looks back at Earth every morning at 10 a.m. Mars time and says, tell me what to do today. And we have to operate so that we always have orders ready for the rover. A Martian day, which is called a sol, a Martian day is 40 minutes longer than an Earth day. So one day on Earth, 24 hours. One day on Mars, 24 hours and 40 minutes.
No, it's not a big difference.
But over time, that means that every day we go in 40 minutes later to work,
right,
every single day.
So you do?
More or less, yeah, we do.
Wow.
And so it's the equivalent of you're jumping a time zone a day and you kind of work your way all the way around the clock over the course of 36 days. And so by working on Mars time, you're really just continually changing the time of day that you go to sleep, that you eat, that you do all of those things to follow the time on Mars.
I guess you have to.
Yeah, you really do have to.
Otherwise, you're getting up in the middle of the night. So this way, it's always, you know. But what's interesting is that you also got your family to do it. Your wife, your 13-year-old son, your 10-year-old daughter, and your 8-year-old daughter all lived on Mars time.
That's right. My 8-year-old son.
Devin, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and that was really my wife's brainchild because I had to go do this crazy schedule. But in August, the kids weren't in school, and if I was going to see them at all, we were going to have to do something with the family.
Well, that's a
so
good
we
idea.
Took the whole family onto Mars time.
Yeah. Now, once school started, they went back on Earth time.
Yeah, they did. Okay. They did go back on Earth time.
Because
but in the meantime, in August, you know, they stayed up all night and did all that stuff with me.
Yeah. Wow, that's kind of neat. And how did they like it? I know your son has a blog on it.
They loved it because they got to see a whole bunch of stuff they had never seen before.
Right.
They got to see Hollywood at midnight and see all the people there. They got to go to all-night diners. We did a picnic out in Santa Monica Beach at midnight. And we went down into downtown L.A. at 2 o'clock in the morning. They had a great time, and they've come back and asked me, when do we get to do it again? I have to tell them, I don't know you ever get to do it again. You don't get to do that very often. That's a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
You could always do it, but it wouldn't be for any reason. You'd just be doing it.
And, you know, it's actually really hard to do because you've got to line your work life up with it and everything. But really, I think for them, it was a big adventure. And that was what we wanted because we wanted them to feel the adventure of exploring Mars.
Good.
And to get a chance to participate in that. And to them, getting to stay up all night and live around the clock in LA was a big adventure for them. They got to see all sorts of things they'd never seen before. And I think they had a great time. They really had a great time with it. And my wife did too. You know, we joke about missing it every once in a while, how great it was to get to do it.
So you're not going to do another Mars mission?
You mean me personally?
Yeah, or? I mean, maybe you will get to do it again.
Maybe. We're talking about – there's a Mars mission coming up in 2016 for the 2016 launch opportunity called InSight, and that one's being done by JPL. And then we're talking about what to do in Mars 2018 and Mars 2020, whether we should start a Mars sample return, bringing things back from Mars or send orbiters or whatnot. So, yeah, there'll be other missions for me to work on, I think, over time, or I hope so. It all depends on the election and the budget and all of that stuff that we have to – worry about in the government.
I do remember that briefly we were going to go to Mars. We were put a landing, manned landing on Mars. Is that at all in the future, do you think?
I don't think. You know, that would take a lot of money.
It's hard.
And it's also very hard. And
that's a long flight. That's an 8.5-month flight.
I don't see the government or NASA committing that kind of money to do that kind of thing right now.
And would we gain anything from it besides the, you know, the glory of it? Is there scientifically any reason to send a person?
Well, I'm sure we'd gain something scientifically from it. Whether we would gain more than we would have gained from sending robots, I don't know. All the gain, though, is in having the person go. I mean, because, you know, if you get to go, you get to be you get to have your name remembered 500 years ago and from now, along with Christopher Columbus and Charles Lindbergh and Neil Armstrong, right? That's
I'd do it. I'm volunteering. I know I'm too old and fat, but I'm volunteering. I would do it in a heartbeat. You wouldn't have to. And I bet you that there's millions of people who would say the same thing. How about private space?
I think private space is showing a lot of promise these days, particularly for launch vehicles like SpaceX. They had a successful launch, mostly successful launch over the past week. And one of the key problems with space travel is just that it's expensive to get to orbit. And NASA and JPL, we're really good at doing things first, but we are not the low bidder, and I don't think we ever will be. So it is great to see some of the hard work of getting to orbit go out into commercial industry where they're a lot more cost focused and they can do things differently and do things cheaper. And if they really can, if SpaceX can accomplish its goals, its stated goals of trying to lower the cost of getting to space by a factor of 5 or 10, that'll revolutionize everything to do with space travel. Human, robotic, satellites that we watch television on, all of that stuff could be revolutionized by that.
Sure. I guess a space elevator is one of the ways you could make it cheaper to get out. So that's the most expensive thing is getting into orbit, getting out of the Earth's gravitational
field. Yeah, that's still the most expensive thing. The reason we don't make anything in space is because the cost of taking, say, a pound of sand to space, if you could take a pound of sand to space and convert it to gold and bring it back and then sell it, you'd still lose money because it costs you so much to get the sand up to space to begin with.
But I hear there's a big diamond out there.
Well, there are people talking about trying to bring asteroids from deep in space back to the Earth and get minerals and stuff off of that too. That's an adventure, and I don't know if that really works. We'll find out. There are people who are trying to do it.
I feel that we need it for our own spirit as much as for the science of it. That it is so important for the human spirit to explore beyond our planet.
I think that's really true. And I also think, even in very practical terms, people use space all the time and they take it for granted now. So if you watch satellite TV, if you watch DirecTV or Dish Network, if you listen to a weather report, if you use a GPS, if you try to find your location on your iPhone, if you watch cable television, all of that, CNN and ESPN are all distributed by satellite. Space has actually literally revolutionized the world that we live in. And it's so common now that we take it for granted. Most people use space every single day, and they don't even realize it. Every time you open up your cell phone and you're looking for where the nearest hamburger joint is, you're using GPS satellites. So it's really changed our lives in very practical ways, as well as giving that great sense of adventure and exploration that helps drive the society forward.
So there are people watching right now there are a lot of young people watching, kids who are thinking about what to study in college. There's people who are interested in this. How would you encourage them to get involved? What should people be doing?
I encourage everybody who has even a little bit of interest in math and science to go off and pursue it. Because using math and science, you can change the world. You can change the world in space travel. You can change the world in Facebook. You can do whatever. And I hope that the space program inspires people to go off and do that. For folks who are older, who are in college and are looking at what to major in, my advice, and I actually think this is very practical advice, is if you have any interest in technical things, math and science, take the most technical degree you can get.
Really?
Because if you get a physics degree, you can always decide later, hey, I'm going to be an engineer, or I'm going to be a lawyer or a doctor or an entrepreneur, or I'm going to work on Wall Street, or I'm going to work in television, or I'm going to work in podcasting.
Straight down, by the way, David. Started out there and now podcasting.
But if you start in college with something that's non-technical and you ever decide later, hey, I want to go back and be an engineer – it's much harder to switch back.
You can't go. I got to tell my son this because, you know, it's interesting. He's like you. He's very interested in music and music composition and logic and stuff. But he's suddenly gotten excited by physics. And I got to say that. Do the physics first. You can do the music, but do the physics because you can always do the music later.
You can get the engineering degree when you're in college. It opens a million possibilities now.
Yeah, that's really true.
And you can always decide later you want to do music. And I promise you, if you decide you want to do music, you will not regret getting the engineering degree.
Yeah.
You really won't.
I was so thrilled. He came to me the other day and said, did you know the GPS uses relativity is a applied example of the Einsteinian theory of relativity. I said, is it? Tell me all about it. And it was really exciting for me to hear that coming out of his mouth. That was really, really cool.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, David, you've done probably one of the coolest things of the year, landing a Volkswagen-size Explorer and Space Lab on the surface of a planet 8.5 months away via spaceship. That's straight. Did you ever think as a kid you'd be doing that?
I think working on the Mars rover has been on my bucket list ever since I came out of college. So
check
that one off now.
Check what? What do you think's next on that bucket list?
I don't know. I'm working on ultralight solar rays for big human missions now, and I would always like to go back and work on another Mars mission or another deep space mission. I think I want to do more rocket science again. I think we want to work on more plasma thrusters.
Yeah,
that has kind of a cool ring to it too.
Yeah.
Go back and do a little bit more of that too.
We need that warp drive.
Definitely, I'll put that on the list.
Put that on the list, would you? What do you mean the solar, like solar for power in space for manned missions?
Yeah, so actually, the company I'm at right now is trying to build solar arrays that are 4 times lighter than the solar arrays we have now.
Oh, wow.
And once they get that light, you can actually start using solar arrays plus plasma thrusters to move people around the solar system, and so they can take people to go visit asteroids using
very
plasma.
Very slowly,
but much more efficiently than if you try and do it using normal rockets. So
well,
you don't have to.
Slow is a good thing because all that you know, that all the G forces, that's not good for you.
You can take your time when you're going to visit an asteroid or something like that, too. It's a little different.
It's not going anywhere. You know where it's going to be next month, the month after. All right, so I'm going to give the chat room a chance to ask David O. some questions. A few more minutes, David, if you don't mind. First, I want to tell everybody about Ford and talk about technology. You would think, you know, a 100-year-old car company, what could they possibly have to say about technology? Let me tell you, today's Ford vehicle is a massive technology, including an applied example of Einsteinian relativity, also known as your Ford Sync. It can tell you where you are, where you're going, give you turn-by-turn directions, and at the same time as it's doing that, it can command your music player to play your favorite song or artist or tell. You can even say to the Ford Sync, it's all voice-activated. And the idea of that is for safety. Keep your eye on the road and your hands on the wheel, of course. But you could say, play more like that. I like that song. And it will do that. If you're listening to the HD radio on a Ford Sync with available My Ford Touch, you can say, tag that. I want to buy that when I get home. I like that song. And the iTunes tagging will do that. I just tried it with my iPhone 5. The lightning cable works great because all Ford Sync vehicles have at least one, sometimes two USB ports, charging ports. They even charge when the car is turned off. But they also allow you to control the iPhone 5 with your voice. It works perfectly. I wasn't sure with the new Lightning connector. It does, I could say. I tried it in my 2010 Mustang, and it works fantastically. Ford is really a leader in this. They see the car as a platform. They realize that you're going to have that car for years, but you're going to have a new cell phone every couple of years. There's new apps coming all the time. So they've made an API, they call it AppLink, into Sync so that the apps can work with Sync. They've given you voice control. You even get voice control of your cell phone through this API. It really is it's really a great example of engineering done right. I want you to see more at Ford.com/technology. Or go to your Ford dealer and drive one. Say, I'm here to test drive the Sync. I'll do a car and the Sync, okay? Ford.com/technology. Go further in a Ford, and we thank them for their support of triangulation. All right. Chat room. Nerve asks, what types of missions can Curiosity perform? What is the agenda? What is Curiosity designed to do?
What Curiosity is designed to do is a science mission, is to look at Mars and try and figure out whether Mars ever could have supported life or might be able to support life today using its scientific instruments. So it has these laboratories on board that can look for organic chemicals, which are one of the signs that it might have been able to support life. It has a weather station on board. It has these lasers which can look at the composition of rocks as well as the cameras. So that's its main mission. It's scientific. To see if Mars was ever habitable is what the scientists call it.
That's a great one. And why is it that we want to know that?
I think one of the big questions is still whether Mars ever supported life.
Right.
And this is all related, again, to having found evidence that there was water on Mars. Figuring out where the water went is one thing. But everywhere on Earth that we have water, no matter how cold it is, no matter how deep it is, no matter how dark it is, we have found life. And the natural question is, hey, on Mars, if there was water, does that mean there was life there before?
Right.
And this is another step in answering that question.
If there were life, are there things on Curiosity that it could detect it? If there were microbes alive now on Mars, could Curiosity detect that?
The scientists have been very, very careful to say that they don't guarantee that Curiosity can find life. Actually, finding life is very difficult. And I think that was one of the things we learned from Viking. You have to make certain assumptions about what the life is doing and how to find it to be sure that you found it. But it can find all of the signs of it. And maybe if we got lucky, we could find life if it's there.
It's kind of like the Higgs boson. It's easier to see the outcome of it than the actual boson itself.
I think that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah.
We can see the signs that life was there easier than we can actually find the life itself.
The byproducts, so to speak. Mm-hmm. That was Curtis B's question. Kerfuffle says, I'm an engineering student. I would love to intern at JPL or NASA. What is it that they're looking for? What kinds of things should I be doing to improve my chance of such a job?
I think we take a lot of interns at NASA. We also get a lot of people who apply. You should be a top engineering student, do very well in your classes. If you happen to go to a top school, that helps. There are certain schools that we reach out to all the time. If you don't, I think it really helps when you put your resume in to have some strong recommendation letters from people, professors, better people that you worked with who can say, yeah, this is a kid that you should really consider looking at. Because we get a lot of great people who apply, and we like to see those types of things. We like to see the excitement and the evidence that, hey, you know how to do some hard work.
And that is a plum gig, boy, if you can get it. How long is Curiosity designed? I know these rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, lasted so much longer than they were expected to last. How long is Curiosity designed to last for?
Curiosity is designed to last at least 2 Earth years, which is 1 Martian year. But I think we hope that it will last much longer. I hope that it's lasting long enough that my kids could graduate from college and go drive it around someday.
Oh, wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah.
That would be awesome. Yeah. And when you drive what do you do? There's no joystick. You go left, right, up, down.
No. In fact, the rover's pretty smart. You can it has intelligent software on board so that you can eventually tell it, go over there.
Go there, yeah.
And it will look at the rocks around it and stuff and figure out what's around it and then figure out the easiest way to get there by itself. And if it gets into trouble, it will stop and it will call back to Earth and say, hey, help me. So it's got all sorts of smarts built into it.
We've really gotten, even if we're as slow a processor it is compared to, say, compared to your iPhone or modern computers, these are still much better computers than they were 10 years ago or 20 or 30 years ago. And it really is conceivable to have an autonomous vehicle at this point.
The vehicle has really a lot of smarts built into it.
Yeah.
And, there's a lot of stuff we do on our iPhone that's kind of wasteful of the processing power, too. You can only play so much Angry Birds on that 1 gigahertz processor. We don't have that running on the rover.
That's a very good point. How is it powered? Is it plutonium? Is it nuclear? Or is it batteries, solar?
It is powered by plutonium. There's what's called a plutonium radioisotope thermal generator. So we take the heat generated by the plutonium and we turn it into electricity. We do store it in a battery. So it kind of charges up this battery overnight. And then we wake up in the morning and we drive the battery down. And then we go to sleep and it charges the battery back up. But that plutonium power source will last for decades.
Yeah.
It could keep going for a long time.
Yeah. What would be the thing that would give out then? Why 2 years? You should be able to go a long time.
Oh, we should be able to go longer than 2 years. There are moving parts. Eventually, motors wear out and things happen. The Spirit, lost a wheel at one point. And Opportunity is still going around on the surface of Mars, though.
I know. It's so cool.
Yeah.
It won't give up.
Just keeps on going.
Now, we humans, we mere lay people, we personify these things. We anthropomorphize. I mean, they really feel like, and it doesn't hurt that it's got a Twitter account. Do you, as scientists, do you kind of start to feel about curiosity like she's a thing, a person or something?
Absolutely. I think it's a she, personally.
She, yeah.
I don't call it a he. I've heard engineers, they refer to the different parts of the flight software by the gender of the person who wrote it. So she did this and he did this. And the rover starts getting multiple personalities sometimes. But it really, you talk about it, you can think of it like a person. It goes to sleep at night, wakes up during the day, it goes off to do its thing, calls back home, says, what should I do? It really is kind of like a person like that.
That's really neat. What's the range that it can go in a day?
We've been driving it maybe 50, 60 feet, I think.
Okay.
But eventually we hope it can go 100 yards in a day. That's when we have all the smarts on board, when we're sure all the smarts on board are working. So we have all this intelligent software, but just like the landing, we can't test it on Mars until we get to Mars.
Right.
So we're taking time making sure that
everything
works before we let it give it the car keys and let it go off on its own.
And eventually you want to get to that mountain in the distance? Is that the goal?
That's right. We want to get to this big mountain called Mount Sharp, which is way off in the distance in the middle of the crater. Because when we look at it, we can see that it has layers in it, like the Grand Canyon has layers. Or when you go into the deserts in Arizona, you can see layers of rock that trace back the history of Mars as you go through the different layers. So by studying the layers, we'll be able to study what happened in the past on Mars and sort of go through its whole history.
Wow. Any other questions by the way, Cool Breeze says, during the landing, Curiosity's tweets were hysterical. They were. It was, and that helps to the personification of it as well, because you really feel like we're hearing from her.
Right.
And it was the same with Opportunity, too. It was just, it's so cool. I think that's... Curtis B. says, you mentioned it earlier that the orbiter only talks to Curiosity once a day. How many times does the satellite, the orbiter, orbit in a day? Is it because it's not positioned properly in other orbits that it doesn't get to talk to it enough?
So I simplified a little for the example there. There are actually two orbiters in orbit around Mars that talk to the spacecraft, that talk to the rover every day, and each one gets two passes over the vehicle. So we get four chances to talk to the vehicle. But when you sum up all of the data that we get over all four passes, we still get about only 50 megabytes a day on average. It's really hard to get data to come 150 million miles.
Two megabits stuns me. That seems like that's great.
That's from the rover to the orbiter right above it.
Yeah.
And then we have to get it from the orbiter back here to on Earth.
But it could transmit almost continuously, probably.
Yes, but not at 2 megabits per second.
But at a much slower rate, yeah. I'm just saying, right. My DSL only go 2 kilometers, so that's pretty darn good.
That's right.
Do you think you will, Terry Kay says, do you think you will use the sky crane method again?
I think there's fair odds we will. Having gotten it to work once, there's no need to go reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
But we're really – the Mars program is in a period of being redone, because we had ideas on what we wanted to do with it, and in the end it turned out there was no money to do what they wanted to do with it. So they're trying to scale it down and find cheaper ways of doing things. So we'll have to see what comes out. I don't think we know exactly what the Mars program will look like going forward. And a lot of it really depends on what happens in the election and what happens in the budget cycle and things like that.
You know, the annual budget for NASA is so tiny compared to the federal budget. And this stuff is so... important. Just write your member of Congress. Now's a good time because they're up for election. You know, they might listen to you and say, you know,
it's one.
Go ahead.
It's the money spent on NASA is 0.5% of the federal budget. It's 0.5 on every dollar spent by the federal government.
And
it's just a tiny, tiny fraction.
We get so much out of it in terms of science, but also in terms of excitement and the human, and you know, just celebration of the human spirit. Are there now? Mars is the easiest planet that we can get to. Are we contemplating Mercury or Jupiter or somewhere else, or is this like pretty much it?
Well, there's a spacecraft on the way to Pluto. There's a spacecraft on
it's
the way to Jupiter.
Fly by. No landing.
Right.
Yeah.
There's no landing on Pluto. Oh, you're asking where are we contemplating landing?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a different question. There are people who are contemplating landing on Venus, which is a very difficult target, trying to get down there. There are people who want to take a good close look at Europa, which is a moon of Jupiter. I think a landing may be a little bit too adventurous for now, but for now they definitely want to get in close and take a good look at it. And there are people who are talking about trying to land on asteroids. There's a mission they're working on which is going to try and go to an asteroid and collect a sample and bring it back to Earth so we can look at it. And that's not something which is a decade off. That's something that's just a couple of years off. Being built by our friends out in Maryland at Goddard Space Flight Center.
Well, there's a potential financial value to landing on asteroids and harvesting asteroids that might stimulate.
There's
that.
A private company that has started up for the purpose of trying to harvest asteroids or look at harvesting asteroids for the economic benefit.
David, you've been very generous of your time. I thank you so much for being here, and thank you for the work you've done and the inspiration that you've given us all. It's just very exciting.
Thank you very much, Leo. I had a great time.
David O., Lead Flight Director, Mars Science Lab Curiosity. Thank you, David. Take care.
Thank you.
And thank you for being here on Triangulation. I love this show. You never know who we're going to meet. Actually, I do kind of know who we're going to meet coming up in future episodes. Next week, the man who started Friendster, Jonathan Abrams, he's a serial entrepreneur, and his latest Nuzzle is really a great way to keep up on news. It's personalized news feeds from Twitter. That's going to be fantastic. Tom and Sarah are going to get to do their own version of Triangulation in November when I'm off on vacation. I know Penny Arcade is the topic of Tom's show. I'm not sure about the rest. And for our Halloween edition, Richard Cadry, Kill the Dead, will join us on Triangulation. I'll have to do that one in costume, I believe. Stay tuned. Inside Twit is next. Thank you, David. Really great. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's just morning. It's still just morning Mars time, so your day has just begun. Think of it that way.
That's right. That's right.
I did notice in Twitter today there's some question over, I mean, we call the current Sol was yestersol.
I love that.
But what are we going to call the Sol after
Solaro.
This Sol?
Nextersol. I like Nextersol. I like that.
I think my family was using Tomorrow Sol for a while, but Sol Morrow has a certain ring to it.
Nextersol. I vote for Nextersol.
I love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You have a good day.
All Bye. Right, you too.
Thanks.
We do Triangulation every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC. Please tune and watch live because, frankly, I need your questions. It's really great. I love this part of the show where we can give you a chance to ask questions. We have such great guests. I'm going to need your help with Richard Cadry, so I want you to tune in for Halloween at least. If you can't watch live, of course, you can always watch on demand after the fact. We make audio and video versions available at twit.tv/TR. If you want to watch previous episodes or just download them and keep them forever as a little keepsake, a little memento. I thank Karsten Bondi, our producer. He's booking such great guests. Karsten, nice job. I hope we'll see you next time on Triangulation.